I hope you can all get comfortable, that we're kind of cozy in here today. Let me get the official introduction in for the tape. My name is Dan Spencer, and this is a second of a five-part series on being gay and Christian in the church. Although Thoreau's birthday kind of threw me for a loop, and I had originally planned to have this session be at the end of the five parts rather than the second, but I think it'll work in nicely. In honor of Thoreau today, we're going to look a little bit at a more creation-centered spirituality, honoring Thoreau's commitment to our universe and to ecology and to creation, and take a look at what that might mean for us today. I'm also going to tie that in as to spirituality among gay and lesbian Christians, which may seem a little strange at first, but I think you'll see how they tie together. At least I hope you will, because they do for me. So for those of you who, I normally, the second session I usually do in looking at the issues of gay and lesbian Christians is looking at the Bible, because I know many people have a lot of legitimate concerns about that, but I'm asking that you hold those questions for one more session, because the third and fourth sessions will be on what does the Bible say. Today I want to look more at the kind of spirituality that emerges from using creation as a center of our spirituality, and what lesbians and gay men may have to contribute to that. I'm going to do that by making reference to a book by Matthew Fox called Original Blessing, where he is working with many other people to recover spirituality centered around the God's gift of creation. And he lays out many different themes in that, all of which we can't, of course, cover today, but we can highlight some certain things. And tie that into, then, Thoreau's appreciation of the out-of-doors. Fox begins by a question in his book. He asks us, in our quest for wisdom and survival today, does the human race require a new religious paradigm? And if so, does creation-centered spirituality offer such a paradigm? Now, obviously, Fox is going to answer both questions yes, and that's the reason for writing his book. But the point is looking at those questions and asking, what can we recover out of our tradition that helps us confront the very dangerous and difficult situation we find in our world today? And Fox begins by looking at the need to recover wisdom within our religious experience, our religious paradigm. And he defines that using a Native American definition of wisdom, meaning simply that the people may live in its broadest sense, not that we just survive, but that we live using all of the gifts that are available to us and build life based on that. And Fox notes that traditionally there have been two sources of wisdom that people have looked to throughout the ages. One has been nature. There have been many in the Native American traditions, many traditions have looked to nature to find wisdom, to find ways in order to live more fully. And the other has been the whole area of religious experience and the religious beliefs we have, the traditions that are passed down from parent to child throughout our human family. And Fox notes that traditionally there was no gulf between the two. Religion and science complemented each other. We asked many of the questions of science coming out of our religious experience, and many of the answers we found in science informed our religion. But unfortunately, in the last 300 years or so, with the period of the Enlightenment in Western society, there has emerged a very deep gulf between science and religion, each being very antagonistic towards the other. And this has resulted in, I think, a very tragic situation where science has oftentimes developed without reference to ethical guidelines, and religion has been confined to a narrower and narrower field and not addressing some of the major questions we need to address today. What Fox is trying to do is to look at ways that we can bridge that gap and bring them back together. And he starts by looking at where he thinks the problem comes from in religion today in terms of our spirituality. Fox claims that one of the major sources of the problem for us has been an increasing reliance almost exclusively in Christianity on what he calls a fall redemption spirituality, a spirituality that begins with the human fall from grace and then focuses itself exclusively on being redeemed. And I'll talk a little bit more about why Fox claims that that has been the problem. But what Matthew Fox claims then is that we need to recover, to incorporate the fall redemption spirituality into a broader framework that is what he calls creation-centered. He cites a number of reasons for this, 10 reasons. I'm not going to go through all 10, but just some areas where the fall redemption spirituality has not given us the resources to confront some of the dramatic problems we have that he claims a creation-centered spirituality can. The first one is he mentions the global crises that confront us. And points out two. One, the whole environmental or ecological crisis that's facing our world. And we had a forum that dealt with much of that last night. And the lack of resources in a fall redemption spirituality is aimed much more towards the individual soul to confront the environmental crisis today. The second crisis he calls the economic crisis or the global crisis of mass poverty, mass oppression, mass unemployment that's confronting us, and the need for a global restructuring to bring justice about, and how we need to develop a spirituality that allows us to confront that. Secondly, Fox notes the new paradigms taking place in the field of science. Science for the last 300 or 400 years has worked under the paradigm set by Isaac Newton, which is a very mechanistic, rules of nature-oriented science. But increasingly, science is working more and more out of the mode of Einstein, which is the whole area of relativity, and that instead of being a more mechanical mode of the universe, is a much more organic mode where things interrelate and interdepend on each other. And within that mode, there's a real realm for the spiritual as well. Fox notes the increasing emphasis on global ecumenism. After centuries of mutual antagonism between different religions and denominations, increasingly we're seeing a spirit of ecumenism trying to find what we hold in common to face the problems that face us rather than what divides us. He notes the increasing movements of liberation movements and justice movements among people of color, women, lesbian, gay people, the elderly, physically disabled, and so forth and so on. People who are beginning to claim that my experience or our experience is important and valid, and we have a place in creation as well. He particularly notes the development of feminism and the tremendous contributions and challenges that women through feminism are making upon our religious way of thinking and seeing and structuring the world. Talks a little bit about the change in the way we approach education, that education for so long now has been almost exclusively oriented towards the rational, logical ways of thinking, and we have marginalized or pushed to the side the whole artistic side of ourselves, what people are increasingly calling the right brain, the part that is non-rational but more creative and artistic, and how we need to incorporate that back into our spirituality as well. And finally, Fox says that if we're going to confront the world today, out of our spirituality, we need to have a spirituality that nurtures and develops hope, in contrast to the pessimism and cynicism and even sadism that constitutes much of our way of approaching the world today. I think we see this particularly in our own culture with many of the problems of the youth, the problems of the family, alcoholism, many different areas. We see a widespread despair and lack of hope today. And Fox says we need to recapture the hope that's inherent in our religious tradition to be able to confront that. So he does that by laying out what he calls a recovery of a creation-centered spirituality. He maintains, and I would agree with him, that the creation-centered spirituality is actually the most ancient of them. It's the one that our forebears thousands of years developed out of their love and appreciation for the land. And it's only been in the last 1,500 years or so that it's been pushed aside in favor of a fall redemption spirituality. If you were at the Bible study this morning, in fact, I hope you all were. It was an incredible Bible study, and I want to touch on many of the things that Susan brought out of the Gospel of John, because I think it fits in beautifully into what we're talking about today. But Mike Pellett brought up the whole doctrine of original sin and how that was developed not so much out of, it wasn't a concept that was even people were aware of during the time of Jesus. The time of the writing of the Bible was developed much later, primarily through Augustine and then later in the Catholic and other traditions after that. But that, primarily with Augustine, we see a shift in the way Christianity views itself and the kinds of questions it asks towards a much more personal, individual, interior-oriented mode of being, focusing on what Augustine called the state of our original sin, our state of our fallenness, and then into me to move from that into being redeemed, called back to our relationship with God. The fall redemptive spirituality is, as I mentioned, uses as a starting point the fall, or what it calls original sin, our state of brokenness and our state of sin. And traditionally, it put out a threefold path to gain spiritual enlightenment or reunion with God. The first is, this was known in the Neoplatonic tradition as purgation, illumination, and union. And very simply, with the danger of vastly oversimplifying, the purgation was purging ourselves of the evil influence of sin or brokenness. Illumination took place as a result of the purging or cleansing of ourselves. And out of the illumination, then, it was made possible to have the union with God. Very much the sense of fleeing the broken world, the sinful body, to have the soul's reunion with God in the more holy, pure, spiritual realm. And Fox points out the tremendous negative effects that has had on many aspects of our world. A denial of the importance of this world in favor of the coming world. Especially the oppression of people who were seen to be more bodily oriented, particularly women who became associated with the body, as opposed to men who became associated with the spirit of the soul, and the oppression of women that resulted out of that. And this fall redemption spirituality has been used traditionally to oppress people. Many, many different groups have been victimized by it. It was used to justify slavery. It was used to justify the oppression of women. It was used to justify killing gay men and lesbians, because we were all associated with the body, with the evil, broken world. Some of the characteristics of the fall redemption spirituality are that it is dualistic. It creates strong distinctions between God and humanity, between, as I mentioned, between body and soul, men and women, so forth. It tends to be a very individualistic or individual-oriented spirituality, so that one does not find God by turning outward to the world and to other people, but by turning inward to the soul and meditating on the soul and eventually purging oneself in order to have the soul's union with God. And it also, as I mentioned, is non-creation-centered. The world is seen primarily as a locus of sin and evil. Our union with God, our salvation comes from fleeing the world. Now, I realize I'm painting broad generalizations, and many of these things are probably not fair to some of the finer points of the spirituality, but this has been at least much of the popular understanding or the common understanding that has developed out of it. And I think we can see it in many ways. I was just thinking about some examples that are particularly maybe extreme, but also very frightening. I don't know if you remember Interior Secretary James Watt about 6 or 7 years ago, a devout Christian, but I think he operates very much out of this mentality. And I remember at one point him saying that Jesus is going to return, when he was being asked about strip mining and clear-cutting the forest and what environmentalists were terming very ecologically damaging use of the land. And he responded by saying, when Jesus returns soon, he's going to ask us how we use the world, not how we saved it. But it was a very strong mentality of the world is here to be used now for our use, and that's the ultimate goal is the next life. Probably one of the more extreme examples of this are Christians who actually wait for nuclear war, seeing that as the second Armageddon that will usher in the new age, and so see the destruction of this planet as a sign of the new age coming, rather than our call to be stewards and nurture the planet. Again, some of the more extreme forms, but I think they point out the dangers that have developed for us out of this exclusive reliance on this spirituality. Out of my own experience, as a gay man, I think we've felt the brunt of this, particularly because sexuality and sex have been very intimately tied with sinfulness. And Mike again mentioned this morning, this was one of the reasons for requiring celibacy and in the Catholic tradition for priests, because the whole act of procreation or sex and sexuality was seen as inherently sinful. And therefore, to try and get away from that, you had to abstain from that. We still see the effects of this today, oriented towards gay and lesbian people. We've been, through the ages, oppressed for it because we're defined by our sexuality. And so we're defined by, in this mode of thinking, our sinfulness. And we are, and when we claim to be open about that, then we're defined by, according to this mode, our rebelliousness of refusing to recognize our sinfulness, that we're inherently sinful. And this is still used today very much in terms of things like the question of ordination. Some churches now say it's not a sin to be homosexual itself in your orientation, but the minute you act on it, what they call practicing it, makes you sinful. There's still very much a tied-in notionality of some aspects of sexuality being sinful. And so for me, I came to creation-centered spirituality, interestingly enough, primarily out of my love of the land and my background as a geologist, and always having a hard time with understanding my love of the world with the very narrow Christian faith that I was experiencing that didn't take that love into account. In fact, I oftentimes had people tell me, if you try and find God in nature, that's sinful, or you're missing the boat, or that's not Christian, that God is not to be found in nature. That's what the pagans do. This was very hard for me because I'd sit up on top of a mountaintop and just loving everything I was seeing and then remind myself, but this is being sinful. I should be thinking on Jesus Christ as my personal Lord and Savior. That's a little extreme, but that was the kind of the gulf that I was having. Creation-centered spirituality tries to recover the more ancient, broader mode of starting not with, its starting point is not original sin or our fallenness. Rather, its starting point is the title of the book, what Matthew Fox calls our state of original blessing. That the cosmos, the universe, the world is a gift that God has given all of us. And we are a part of that world, probably not the center of it, but we're a part of it. And we need to celebrate the blessing that we have in that world and that we are as part of that world. And so the creation-centered spirituality begins with celebration and thanksgiving for the blessing that we have received from God. Instead of having a threefold path, creation-centered spirituality recognizes a fourfold path. And I'll go through these briefly, and then we're going to come back to them in a minute to talk a little bit more about each one. Remember, the threefold path in the traditional fall redemption spirituality was purgation, illumination, and union. Starting with sinfulness and purging ourselves out in order to be able to be unified with God. In creation-centered spirituality, you begin with creation. Fox calls them, he labels them the four paths, or he uses the Latin term via. The first one being the via positiva. I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce these correctly. I always confuse between Spanish, Latin, and English. So via positiva, meaning the positive or the creation-centered path. It's the path of thanksgiving for the blessings we've received. The second path is the via negativa. This is the recognition that in addition to there being tremendous blessing and light in the world, there is also tremendous darkness and pain and suffering. And so it's a recognition that that is part of the cosmos. That's part of the experience of being in this world. And it's not something to be fled, it's just something to be recognized and enter into in order to move beyond it. And so the whole experience of darkness and pain is accepted as part of this experience of what it means to be spiritual. The third path he calls the via creativa, or the creative, creation-oriented path. This is a recognition that true creativity, true creation, comes out of the union of the first two. It comes out of the acceptance of the gift of life and also the acceptance of the experience of pain and suffering. And out of that comes creativity, God creating the world and our own participation in creation. And then the fourth path he calls the via transformativa, or the transformative path, which is a recognition that creativity in and of itself does not state whether it's positive or negative. You can have, in fact, I think the nuclear bomb is probably one of the best examples of tremendous creative potential, but also tremendous negative evil potential with it. So there's a recognition that creativity needs to be shaped by our relationship with God, to be transformed into transforming the world. And this is the whole area where things such as social justice and compassion come in. Taking our tremendous creative potential for good and transforming the world with that. And so it is in fact, Fox labels this more actually a spiral than a path. Because each one of these steps are steps that we return to many times during our lives, depending on where we are at any point. If, for example, you have just lost a loved one, a very dear friend or family member, it will probably be impossible for you to be in the state of thanking, blessing, or the via positiva. That's a point where we need to experience the depth of the pain and the suffering in the world, but not only to stay there, but to move on that. And if you talk with people who have experienced tremendous pain and suffering and have moved beyond that, they'll talk to you oftentimes about what it was like. They needed to just be with that pain for a while. What was most helpful to them in that time usually is someone who was simply there with them, not telling them to move on and to get a stiff upper lip and move along, simply was there with them during their pain until they were able to move beyond that and again affirm the goodness of creation. Let me just pause here and just ask if there are any questions on this rough outline at this point. Because what I want to do next is to go talk about a few things where I think this intersects with particularly gay and lesbian experience, and then areas where gay and lesbian Christians can contribute to the church, and then open up for wider discussion as well. But as far as laying out the creation-centered spirituality, does this click or make sense in terms of some of the questions you've had or things you've been hearing? It's a question
that makes sense to me. The problem I have is how one can so easily make a switch from fall redemption, from a fall redemption faith to a creation-centered spirituality. I mean, to do that is to dismiss so much in the history of theology that seems so deeply rooted in the gospel. You know, that it's very suspicious.
The question is, for the people who may not have heard it over the tape, is how does one make such a dramatic shift from a fall redemption spirituality, which seems to be very rooted in the gospel and our faith for many years, to this creation-centered? I can't go into all the examples of that, because that's a lot of what Fox does, but I think that what Fox claims is, and we can challenge him on this claim, is that fall redemption is actually a distortion of the earlier form of the Gospels, that you can read fall redemption theology back into the Gospels, and he claims that's what most of us have been doing since the time of Augustine, but that if you set aside the way Augustine read the Gospels, and we've read it since, and try and go back and do the exegesis of trying to understand what the Hebrew mindset, the Greek mindsets, those mindsets of that time were, that many of the things that we learned out of fall redemption, such as individualized salvation of the soul, are actually much later additions to the Christian tradition than the earlier emphases there. For me, a part of that is just looking, for example, looking at the way that Jesus interacted with his world and his comfortable interaction not only with people, but other aspects of the world, with the animals and his time there. Looking at the Hebrew, the traditional Jewish celebration of the earth, the celebration of creation, the creation myths themselves, which celebrate and give lift that up, and the almost the earthiness of the Jewish faith, which I think we've lost a lot of. But you're right in the sense that it isn't an easy transformation, because we are steeped now in 15 centuries of looking at it a different way. One of the most helpful little books I've ever read on that, if you ever get a chance to read, is a book by a man named Christer Stendahl. It's here both in the library and the bookstore, called Paul Among Jew and Gentile. And he takes that very same question that you're raising and takes another look at Paul. He has a little essay in there called Paul and the Introspective Consciousness of the West. And he makes this point there there's a wonderful little phrase there. He says that biblical scholars are often, or historical scholars are oftentimes scandalized when they look at the first four centuries of the church and realize the church didn't use Paul very much, because they seem to take Paul at his word in terms of Paul was talking about the problems that were developing between the Jewish and the Gentile communities. But after the first century, that ceased to be much of a question for them. And so they used other writings more so. And Stendahl says it wasn't until Augustine in the 4th and 5th century that someone finally seemed to understand what made Paul tick. And that is because Augustine went through a terrible, terrible crisis of faith and began to look inwardly And as he did that, he looked at the readings of Paul and found things in Paul that spoke to his situation. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's what Paul was writing about. It's what Augustine found helpful in his time. Fox would argue that unfortunately, while that may have been very important for Augustine and helps many of us at different times, that then in terms distorted the faith from there on so that we begin to lose many of the original things. The kind of things that Susan were talking about this morning in terms of the openness towards creation that we saw in the John's passage there, and the openness to God doing a new work. But you're right, it is a big shift.
Just one other comment.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily see that there's a contradiction between fall redemption theology and creation-centered spirituality because of the via negativa.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that seems to reflect the fall.
The question is, I don't see a contradiction between them because in the via negativa can incorporate the fall. You're right, and this is not to totally negate the other things that are developed out of this. But for example, Fox points out that the way that was experienced so oftentimes in the fall redemption spirituality became asceticism, became the experience of the darkness of suffering. It was experienced through mortification of the flesh, through asceticism, through denying pleasure, so forth. And so it was a shutting off of the senses rather than an entering into. And the kind of very negative results that has had in terms of leading to a sadomasochistic side of the faith. I see that a lot in my work in Central America in terms of what the early church there did to the indigenous people because of their beliefs. And a cutting off of any access to pleasure because of this asceticism, then in turn projected that outward to anybody who was experiencing pleasure, became repressed for it. We see this time and again in the history of the church. So there's room for it, but I think minus the distortions that have built up around it. So hand here and then here. Jim, who was? I saw a hand here, but maybe it was a stretch. Jim.
I think that what Dan says is true in that. In fall redemption kind of theology, the world is to be fled. You are to flee from the world and all of its evil and to flee from the darkness. In creation-centered spirituality, why you enter into it and incorporate it, but you're not afraid of it. A classic example in our the way that we conduct social programs today for the homeless, and I'm going to do a thing on this next week for those of you who are here, is that our basic approach to the homeless is that we see them as fallen, and what we want to do is literally clean them up, because the thing that what they are is a very negative thing. They are dirty and they are unorganized and can't get themselves together, so we want to clean them up and medicate them up so that they can be out of that world that they are thrust in, and redeem them. And instead of entering into that world and transforming it. So that's why we have things like skid roads that are now Pioneer Squares, and Bowery's that are now financial districts, and so on like this. That's our way in fall redemption kind of theology. And if we can't clean them up, you know, then we will get them out of sight. If they won't cooperate in our efforts to redeem them, then we get them out of sight. And that's basically what fundamentalism does with their whole approach to the world. And the world of reality then becomes only the world which is going to heaven and has isolated itself into this perfect sanctified community in which we're all filled with the Holy Spirit, and we heal diseases, and we speak in tongues, and we have a whole separate kind of existence because we're the redeemed.
I remember one of these contradictions for me that developed one time about that. I was talking with another geologist who was a more of a fundamentalist Christian, and I had a hard time understanding one how you can be a geologist and a fundamentalist Christian. But he was explaining to me that his belief was that dinosaur bones had been placed in the ground by Satan in order to throw us off of our faith. Again, a very either-or perspective. Either dinosaur, you know, if we admit the existence of dinosaurs, that threatens the very nature of our faith. And that's very opposed to the creation center spirituality, which means, which is a celebration of that as the diversity of creation. Sharon?
Well, that's the point I was going to make, is that the thing, I think the thing that Fox invites us and that creation centered theology invites us to do is to drop the dualism that was so strong with Augustine, not so strong with Jesus, and not so strong with the Hebrews. And that that instead of seeing, you know, evil and the devil and the darkness as something outside of ourselves, that it too is part of our experience. So it's a more integrated, a more whole approach. And for me, that's the part that makes it so inviting and so redemptive. In fact, the redemption is really on the right side of the chart, not on the on that old dualism side.
Right.
Just a quick question, Dan. Have you made any connections between creation-centered spirituality and the psychological things of Fritz Perls and Gestalt therapy?
I haven't.
Has anybody?
I just thought of it. Seems to me is very strong, like the part about owning the darkness.
Right.
The darkness is part of us.
Shadow side.
That sort of pre-Foxian anyway.
And Fox quotes Jung quite extensively in terms of learning that. This is a side, but just one little plug. If you ever are in need of wonderful little quotes, there are 27 chapters in here, and Fox begins every one of them with a list of about 20 little gems. And so if you don't do anything else, just pick up the book to read through for that. It's sermons and illustrations galore.
Okay. I think another thing that helps us in making the bridge between the two is in the back of the book, the list of theologians that he identifies as being creation-centered. And you mentioned Christer Stendahl of Lutheran. He identifies as a creation-centered theologian. So we have one in the midst of us doing that. Another one that we have lots of his books in the bookstore here on is Walter Brueggemann.
Mm-hmm.
And Fox quotes Brueggemann and lifts him up as a creation-centered theologian in much of what he writes and does. And there's many in here.
He even quotes Martin Luther at one point. He says that Martin Luther talked about us needing to emphasize three things: creation, redemption, sanctification. And he says, why is it that we always forget about creation, start right with redemption and go into sanctification? So there's, you know, many of the things that we don't typically think of in our tradition that support this because we've lost parts of them. And the problem with fall redemption, it's not to move away from an either-or thing. It's not that it's totally false. In fact, oftentimes the most dangerous things for us are partial truths. Things that we know are true, but only partially true. I was going to say I've learned that a lot from visiting U.S. embassies in Central America, but that's a whole other debate. They always tell us the truth, but they only tell us a little part, and that can be very distorting of what actual reality is. And I think that's the case of fall redemption. There is a lot of truth there, but it's distorted because it's cut off from many other areas.
Dan?
Yeah.
Isn't that what Luther did, though? I mean, you keep harkening back to Augustine and harkening back to what you call exclusive reliance on the fall redemption type of thinking. Isn't that exactly what Luther opposed? You know? Purgation, illumination, union. You know, that's what Luther said. This isn't the way to think about God and to think about our relationship to God.
Yeah.
Well, Luther's already gone through what Fox is trying to do.
I think Luther has done a lot of it. Forgive me, I'm not Lutheran, so I haven't studied Luther a lot. But I also remember some of Luther's own battles with his evil, his consciousness, and the what he found in Paul and what he found in Augustine to help him through that, I think as well. But no, I think Luther has. I mean, I think there are contributions from many people along the way. But
there
still,
is
I think that. Go ahead.
There is an article that Fox has written on Lutheran theology from Luther, and he says that if we would go back to Luther and what Luther did with creation, that we would be a much more creation-centered church.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about one of the main sources that Luther used was a Theologica Germanica or someone, they don't know who the author is because he was closeted, because he would have been ousted. But that piece is much of it's a very creation-centered piece, and it highly influenced Luther. And if you write to Fox, you can get a copy of his article when he talks about Luther particularly.
yeah, Luther included the creation aspect of it where maybe, you know, pre-Lutheran, the Augustinian thing didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But he also made a very strong emphasis on redemption and personal salvation,
mm-hmm.
which I don't think we can throw out the window.
No, and I'm not arguing against that either. I'm arguing this is more of a corrective rather than a moving away again from the either-or mentality of we've either got to have one thing or the other and nothing in between. I think there's a lot we can take. Take one more, and then I want to move on, so I don't miss the second part of this.
I also think it's important to realize that Matthew Fox comes out of the Roman Catholic tradition, which I think probably the time he was trained was profoundly preoccupied with sin.
Mm-hmm.
And so that he may be reacting against a slightly different kind of emphasis than we may be out of the Lutheran tradition. I'm not saying that there's not a connection,
sure.
but I think it's always important to look at where the guy's coming from, because he's not reacting to the best of Lutheran theology. He was reacting somewhat to pre-Vatican II Roman Catholic theology.
I think that's true, although I will also say, as a Roman Catholic who's lived my life surrounded by Lutherans, that I don't think we Catholics have a monopoly on dwelling on sin. Lutherans seem to love to dwell on sin in order that they be prepared for grace, but then I'm sorry. What I want to do now is make kind of a shift now, this is a little bit of a risk, because I realize I've just introduced a whole new body of things, and what I'm going to do now is to even make it more non-traditional by talking about contributions of gay and lesbian Christians. It's not something we're used to hearing about in the church. But I think it's important that whether you agree with it or disagree with it, that you hear it, because that's so one of the things that's really sad about our church today is that we oftentimes have excluded the people we disagree with, and so we don't even hear each other anymore. And so many people, as I mentioned last night that I talked to, say, I've never talked with a gay person that I know of, and so I don't even know what they think. Well, I want to just represent, show some of the things, why this is a very redemptive spirituality for we as gay and lesbian Christians. I would do that just by going through a few of the points here and the four paths and talk a little bit from a gay and lesbian perspective. Let me just start by first saying, though, that when I say this, I mean contributions. I mean contributions in the most positive sense. I see contributions as things that empower all of us to claim things, not as something that's an exclusive property of someone. So as I share these from a gay and lesbian perspective, I don't mean to do that by setting this aside as somehow superior to anybody else's experience, but rather that I hope that our experience can empower all of us to move more deeply into our own faith. I think one of the things that Fox talks about is that this spirituality makes room for the prophetic, and it makes room for the voice of what he calls the Anawim, or the little people, the people who have traditionally been excluded from faith, whether those are black people, people, women, and in our case, those being gay people. And I just want to quote one thing that he writes in here. This is another book here that I heartily recommend for people if you're interested in the area of gay and lesbian people in the church. It's called A Challenge to Love, and it's a series of essays, primarily within the Catholic tradition, but very, very helpful in all traditions. He talks about the role of gay people as the Anawim. No, I forgot. I missed it. So let me see if it's in here. I'll come back to that. I thought I had those all marked out. Anyway, one of the new insights for us as gay and lesbian people, and I think this is probably one of the hardest things for us to be able to eventually affirm out of ourselves. It's a long journey. But to get to a point where we can affirm ourselves as a positive part of creation, creation-centered spirituality sets up a attention for us, because it starts by affirming creation as a gift and a blessing. And yet we've internalized through centuries of teaching that we are not a gift and we are definitely not a blessing. And so there's a strong tension there. And one of the hardest things for gay and lesbian people to do is to get to a point where we can affirm ourselves as part of the gift of creation, as part of the blessing. That's a lot of what the Via Positiva is about. That's the celebration of who we are as part of creation. And that, for gay and lesbian people, can be a very difficult and yet a very powerful, powerful experience. It's the experience of reaching the point of self-trust, of, in spite of all the messages we receive from the world, really trusting basically who we are as a part of creation and learning to trust in that, to be thankful for that, to affirm that. The second part then is one I think that we probably have more experience of, at least initially, and that is the via negativa, the experience of pain, suffering, and darkness, learning to experience that, but also learning to let go of that. That, I think, is a powerful part of what it means to be Christian, to enter, as Christ did, into the pain of the world, but not stop there. You enter into it not because the pain is somehow good in itself, but because we enter into it to identify with others and to be able to transform that. Fox mentions just a little bit about this in here when he says, he talks about the dangers of ignoring the via negativa, of not experiencing the pain. When the via negativa is ignored, the prophetic voice is invariably silenced. Life becomes superficial, easily manipulated, and ultimately as boring as it is violent. And above all, cheap. For while the via positiva teaches us the cosmic breadth of all living and our holy relationship to the stars and atoms, to blessed bodiness, the via negativa opens us up to the depths of creation. When one has suffered deep pain and allowed the pain to be pain, one can then visit the Grand Canyon and learn that it has nothing on the human person, who is just as deep and even more powerfully carved over the millions of years of flowing tides of pain. It's the whole experience of letting pain be pain and then being able to let go and move on. And that's an area where I think lesbian and gay Christians really do have a strong contribution to make to the church. Because the very fact of us reaching a point where we can affirm ourselves as gay and affirm ourselves as Christian means that we have had to pass through that path. There's no getting around it. That has to be our experience. I'll just read a section that Fox writes in a little article called "It's the Spiritual Journey of the Homosexual." He talks a little bit about the difference of our experience and why that means our spirituality may have a different point of departure. He says, like any member of an oppressed group, the homosexual will know a lot about darkness, loneliness, and nothingness, and about letting go and letting be. The homosexual child must let go much earlier than most children of the parental, social, or psychological role models that society gives one in the sexual sphere. Such a person will have to let go of the exclusive option of marriage as a lifestyle. The sacrament of coming out is a kind of letting go. A letting go of the images of personhood, sexuality, and selfhood that society has put on one in favor of trusting oneself enough to let oneself be oneself. Part of the profound letting go process that all people must undergo in their spiritual growing is the letting go of pain, of enemies, of hurt, and of guilt. The choice to wallow in one's pain or in one's guilt is a deliberate choice, as can be the deeper option, which is to let go and to move on. But listen to this. Of course, before one can let go of pain, one must first admit to the pain, cease denying it, and allow pain to be pain for a while. The homosexual who has allowed pain to be pain and then let go of it brings healing to others, for all persons suffer pain. Yet judging from our culture's constant flight from pain, heterosexual society is not terribly adept at moving beyond it. Those who have undergone deep experiences of the via negativa, such as gay men and lesbians, can bring prophetic insight about pain and letting go to the greater society. I think that is, again, I think that's an area where we can contribute to what the church needs to do in our society. We have a society that's officially an optimistic society, and yet I think what it does is masks a tremendous amount of pain that all of us experience and yet aren't allowed to talk about that. I once had, when I spoke in a church and I told a little bit about my story and some of the pain about it, one of the people afterwards came up to me and said, I really envy you being able to tell your story and talk about that pain, because I don't feel like I can do that. I'm, you know, I've followed all the right paths. I'm married. I have children. All those things, and I don't feel like there's a space for me to talk about where the pain is. And unfortunately, I think that's too true about our society, and especially about the church. We oftentimes don't allow ourselves to admit to the pain, to move on to it. Somehow admitting to pain means admitting to failure. Somehow we're not good Christians if we're still experiencing pain and things. And just the opposite, I think, should be the truth. If we are following Christ, then we will be the people who are most deeply experiencing the pain of the world in order to move beyond it. That brings us then to the via creativa, which is the area which unifies the two first paths. And Fox asks a very interesting thing. This is the area which is, he calls it befriending cosmic energy. That is, out of the light and out of the darkness, creating new energy out of that. And Fox asks a really interesting question. He says, why is it that there are so many gay people involved in the arts? And in the gay community, we oftentimes think it would be delightful if sometime everybody who was homosexual in orientation suddenly turned purple. Because one, the whole world would realize how extensive we are, but two, one of the things that probably happened, the church music might have a hard time, and certainly many of the church arts, because for many of us as lesbian gay people, the arts have become the way that we've expressed ourselves and the gifts that we feel. And I think that there's something about that, in that the experience of the pain and the suffering and the via negativa can have two effects. It can break a person. It can reduce a person to human wreckage. And there are many, many gay people for whom that has been the result. If you look at alcoholism rates within the gay community, they're very, very high. Suicide rates among homosexual adolescents are five or six times as high as among heterosexual adolescents. It's a very painful experience, and many people do break under that. But the other alternative is to move into the pain and move out beyond it. And that can lead to tremendous creativity when one begins to use a source of pain as a source of creativity to build on. It can be a wonderful, wonderful source leading to unifying these two. And I think that's, again, an area where gay and lesbian Christians can contribute to the church. We don't have any exclusive right to things, but we can make a contribution. The fourth point is the via transformativa, the transforming. Fox calls this the befriending of the new creation, the kind of creation that comes out of the first three. And says it's characterized by compassion, celebration, and justice. That this, in many ways, compassion, celebration, and justice should be the culmination of our spiritual journey. And as I mentioned before, this is what then shapes the kind of creativity. It gives us the norms and guidelines, as Jesus does, in terms of how we shape the creativity, knowing what is helpful to our world. Fox has talked about the role of the Anawim, or the little ones, he talks about in the prophetic role. And I think that this is, again, where gay and lesbian people have a lot to offer. We are a people that have experienced firsthand what it's like to be oppressed, and yet we then can help identify it in others and move beyond it in working for justice for all people. I think there's nothing, for me at least, quite as powerful about experiencing my own oppression, helping me to understand other people's oppression and committed to that. And so things, for example, I remember the first time I was confronted with the issue of inclusive language. It didn't make sense to me, and I really resented having to change all my language from mankind to humankind and so forth. And then when I tied that into a woman friend I was talking to, who talked about her experience of feeling excluded anytime someone opened their mouth. And I thought, wow, that's the same way I feel anytime someone talks about marriage or any time someone talks about having children. I always feel excluded because I'm not allowed into that. And then suddenly that became a very real issue to me. It became very inclusive language became as important to me as gay and lesbian rights. Out of my experience of being excluded, I was able to identify with someone else's. And I think that that is an area, again, where we can bring to the church our need to recognize diversity, our need to be a church that is about compassion, justice, and celebration of our diversity. I'll just close here by listing a few things that are more sort of recapping some of the things, areas where I think gay and lesbian people can make contributions to the church. For those of you who listened to me talk about my own story last night, I think that that in our process of coming out, which Fox calls a sacrament, I think it's a beautiful way of talking about it, but sacrament of coming out, or the sacred journey of coming out and admitting to first to ourselves and then to the world and God who we are, we gain some real insights about traditional Christian theology. One of them is the experience of grace. My whole experience is a trying to become heterosexual, working all the time, that everybody told me that grace was about, or the faith came, grace came through faith, not through works, and yet if I was going to be saved, I had to become a heterosexual, so I worked at it. I can tell you all the ways I worked at it. And then finally realizing I didn't have to work anymore, that I could really accept who I was, that was when grace became such a powerful experience to me, to really know what it meant, that no matter how hard I worked, I wasn't going to do it. If I would just let go and let God, as the cliche says, grace just overwhelmed me. I think gay people can help us recover that sense of grace. I think gay people can also help us understand what it means to count the cost of our faith in a world that doesn't want to understand us. It's most painful when that world is also the church, but there are many other areas where the world doesn't understand us, and yet we can learn what it means to count the cost, celebrate that, experience the pain of that, let go, and move on. And if we take the time to listen to gay and lesbian people who've gone through that, we can learn a lot. I was talking with Peg about the three gay seminarians who are being denied ordination now. They have a tremendous experience of both the positive, the creative side of learning the faith, the very painful side, and how they're trying to integrate those two. But it's the question for us is whether we want to listen to that, if we can be open enough to hearing the contribution they can make so that we can all experience that. One of the areas that I find most exciting and helpful about the gay and lesbian community for the broader community is I think it gives us the possibility of learning new models of relationship, particularly same-gender relationships. We have for too long learned that the only way that men can be in relationship with other men is through competition, through being invulnerable, not breaking down our vulnerability, by having to be in charge, and so I'm in charge, if you're not in charge, I'm going to try and dominate you, or I'll give up and be passive. There's no room for mutuality. In the gay male community, we're learning a lot about how to live relationships out that don't have to be dominant, submissive, that can be mutual. In the lesbian community, we see tremendous bonds of friendship and networking among lesbian women that can teach us so much about what it means to be in relationships that are not dominating. And I was reflecting on that in the Bible study this morning, because when you had mentioned early on, Susan, about the John 9 story, what that might tell us about the AIDS crisis. One of the things that I think, if you think about the way that story ends, it ends with the man who was blind having recovered his sight, but not only physical sight, he now has insight, as Micah was saying, into what the gospel is, into what Jesus means. And that, I think, has been so much the experience of the gay community around AIDS. AIDS has affected our community like we never could have imagined 10 years ago. And yet it's been a tremendous opportunity for us to see how God has worked beautiful, rich good out of a tragic situation. And we have learned things about ourselves that we could offer to the broader community if the community would stop long enough to hear us. And yet, so oftentimes our experience is exactly what the Pharisees experienced there. Instead of becoming insightful, their sight turned them to being more blind. And instead of being willing to listen to Jesus and the blind man, they became more rigid and moved the other direction. Sadly, that's been our experience for the most part of the church. We rejoice on those rare occasions when people react the opposite way, but for the most part, it's been one of rejection, one of, we're forming a new church right now, we can't handle an issue as potentially controversial as this, whatever. We've been told to just hang out in our closets a little bit longer. And I think it's a tremendous loss to all of us. It doesn't help us as gay people to value who we are, but I think the church loses the potential for tremendous richness in diversity. That's the last thing I would mention. I think that that acknowledging the presence and the worthwhileness of gay and lesbian people can help us acknowledge the worthwhileness and wonder of diversity in creation. One of the things that creation-centered spirituality rejoices in is the tremendous diversity that God has given us in creation. And one of the areas of real loss and pain in the Via Negativa is how we have denied that diversity, or how we are, through the ecologic crisis, for example, subverting it. By allowing gay and lesbian people into the church, it allows us to recognize the diversity and find ways to celebrate it instead of try and box it up and push it aside. So I kind of talked at length. I'll end there. But if you have comments or questions at this point, I'd love to hear them. Yeah.
Can you explain a little more about your comments about the AIDS crisis, how it helped out, and what you liked most?
The question is, how has the AIDS crisis helped in terms of bringing about new insights? One of the things that has happened in the gay community is that we have had to develop support systems that just haven't been there. It's taken us about 6 or 7 years to get any federal funding, enough to even begin to look at this. We have experienced being shut off from churches, from hospitals, from social services, from insurance. All those kinds of normal societal channels for support have been denied to us, both legally and through other means. And so we've had to redraw on ourselves to develop networks for that. So you look in the many of the major cities, the AIDS projects have been grassroots efforts to take care of our own people. What we've learned in the process has been a tremendous sense of empowerment, of learning how to love each other in new ways, how to move past the fear that's kept us in our closets. And so you see people for the first time, because of the anger and the pain around the AIDS situation, taking charge of their lives and saying, I will no longer let society tell me who I am. I think Jim could probably give you many examples out of his own community in San Francisco of different ways that people have learned to love and relate to each other that weren't there before, that it has really built community. In the Bible study this morning, people talked about how crisis oftentimes serves to build community. And that certainly has happened in the gay community. The difference from many of the samples that were cited this morning, I remember people cited the example of the little girl who fell down the well, or a fire or an earthquake. The difference for us has been that in those cases, there's also usually a tremendous outpouring of sympathy and empathy for the victims. In our case, there's usually been a tremendous outpouring of hostility and fear towards us as victims. And so we have not been able to count on the broader community for support. That has forced us to work at our own community. And I think it's very much the experience that the early church had of being misunderstood and persecuted both by the religious community and by the political community, so having to turn into its own community to develop the support it needed. Jim?
Yeah, the overwhelming response of the nation to the AIDS crisis is that it's their own fault. It's their own fault. And it's only since the disease the threat of the disease spreading in the heterosexual community that there's been any money coming from Washington. And so as long as only gays are dying, that's fine. We don't need to fund it. But if it's gonna affect the people of America, well then we better do something about it.
If you realize, for example, that not to point fingers at scapegoats, but President Reagan did not mention the word AIDS publicly until it was in either 1985 or 86. I mean, just a couple years ago, you realize how many people were dead already. Not just dying, were already dead, for the leader of our country even would admit it publicly that this was a crisis. And that gives you some idea. If you imagine if it had been toxic shock syndrome, and imagine if there had been 14,000 young women who had died by that time. Do you think he would have waited 9 years to say anything about it?
Look what happened with Legionnaire's disease. I mean,
seven people died.
How many people died in Philadelphia?
60-some.
But it was the American Legion. So, we gathered the nation's resources. So.
The thing is, though, that we can take those experiences of pain and either make them redemptive or make them bitter, embittering. And I think this is where the Christian church has a tremendous contribution to make to the gay and lesbian community. If we can get our act straight and realize that our gospel is one of reconciliation and loving people different than us, we can offer that to the gay and lesbian community so that we don't become embittered, because there's tremendous temptation in the gay community to just tell the rest of the world to screw off, we don't want anything to do with you. We've experienced such pain.
Sorry, yeah.
And it is happening. Many people have left the church and won't come back. And I think that's a real cause for grief among us. But it's very ironic to me that a church that centers its theology around loving our enemies doesn't include homosexual people in that.
respond to your question also. I think it's not just what AIDS has done to the gay community, but what it has done to individual human beings. I remember talking with a friend who was dying from AIDS 3 years ago, who very simply and quietly said, "This is the best thing that has ever happened to me," in terms of finally understanding what's important and what's valuable in life. And just a week ago in Seattle, I listened to a woman who is working a lot with AIDS people right now, who very simply said that she was sure that 95% of the people in the groups that she's working with now would not trade the experience because of what they've learned from it. And so it's been a powerful learning experience for people within the gay community itself. And which is a strange way, perhaps, to find a blessing, but a blessing nonetheless.
I think it's to say that the via negativa is not an experience of being away from God. It's an experience of being right up against the God.
And it's in addition to what Burr was saying, not only the people themselves who suffer from AIDS, but the kind of healing and reconciliation that can happen with family members and loved ones after years of being divided. The issue of homosexuality has divided our families like few other issues have done, and yet so oftentimes the issue of AIDS, tragic as it is, has brought about tremendous healing and reconciliation among families, loved ones that would never have thought it to be possible. So again, echoing what Susan said this morning, not looking at the cause, that God sent AIDS to cause this, but rather seeing out of a tragic situation there can be tremendous blessing and healing. And that, again, is a gift that we can bring to the church if the church will hear it. We're near lunch, so I'm going to close here officially, but if people want to stop and talk informally, that's fine. Thank you again for coming, and on Thursday we'll begin to look at, again, the questions of the Bible.